Yeah.
Six minutes. Oh, please get it.
So, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to continue our discussion on Morphogen gradients. And what I'd like to convince you of is that, on the one hand, the system that we're studying, which is morphogen gradient formation in Drosophila disks, is, on the one hand, studied well enough that it's worth the time for physicists to look at it, and on the other hand, a little too complex, I think, for intuition to work perfectly well, and therefore something that's worth modeling. Now, since it's a mixed audience, I thought I would start by giving some introduction to the system, even though it was in part already introduced by the speakers before me, but this way I'll know that everything was covered. And the first thing I wanted to do is just give you a quick definition of morphogens. Morphogens are signaling proteins that are secreted from a localized source. And so I just, sorry?
Bicoid.
Okay. So that depends. If we call bicoid a morphogen, then okay, fine. So then they might not be secreted. Then they're let's just say they're synthesized at a localized site, and then move to form a concentration gradient. And that cells at various positions along this concentration gradient then respond to it by specifying their fate. And in doing so, the morphogen establishes an axis. And what I'd like to do today is first introduce to you the system in particular that we're working with, show you some recent developments, what I call recent, meaning like 4 years ago, and then tell you what the open questions are that are present in this system. So you've heard already quite a bit about imaginal disks. The way Drosophila develops is that first you have an embryonic stage and then three larval stages. And in the larva, the tissue that will give rise to the adult after metamorphosis is separated from the tissue of the larva itself. And these tissues form so-called imaginal disks inside the larva. And in particular, in this case, you can see this is, for instance, a wing disk, and then there's leg disks. And these disks, in a way, develop somewhat separate from the larval context. And during these larval stages, there is patterning that's going on in the disks, which will then be relevant during metamorphosis to establish the adult body structures. So when we study these specification events, we study them in the larval stages. And this is kind of a graphic of what these imaginal disks look like. They're actually sacs connected, let's say, here at the top. If you look at them on the side, they have what's called a disk proper. It's a pseudo-stratified epithelium. And this is where most of the adult structures will arise from. And then it has a closing membrane on the back called the peripodium. And what I wanted to show you was...
What's that black stuff derived?
So in this particular case, this is the wing disk. This is the so-called wing pouch. It will give rise to the wing structures. And this black stuff, which is equivalent to this stuff here, will give rise to the notum and the back of the fly. Sure. And if you do an antibody staining of the disk and you look at it, this is what it looks like. In particular, this is Nubbin staining, for instance. It shows you the wing pouch, and this is what it looks like on the side. There's the peripodial layer, which is very thin, and you can't really see it in this picture.
Can you just give me the size? How many cells, sort of, you know, in any one direction?
I would say that, for instance, from here to here is about 50 cells, so maybe 100 cells.
Even at the final stage?
Yes, but there's, from here to here, then there's multiple folds that you can see here. So overall, the disk starts out as roughly 50 cells, and at this point here is 50,000 cells total.
I just want to know the maximum linear dimension.
Linear dimension, I would say...
In terms of cell number.
I would say about 100. About 100, I would say, in any direction.
That's what, 200 micrometers?
Yeah. Okay, so in particular, there are two morphogens that we talk about in the fly disk, and those are DPP and wingless. And one interesting thing to know about them is that if you look at the cell population that forms the wing, it's not a homogeneous population. There are some genes that are specifically expressed in the posterior compartment. They're so-called selector genes. And then there are some genes that are expressed, for instance, only on the dorsal surface of the wing. And it's at the interface of these two populations of cells, for instance, posterior and anterior cells, that then these morphogens are made and then spread. And what I want to show you is three properties of morphogens, which I mentioned before, and that, well, you can see they're made in a localized source. But the two other are that they act directly at a distance and that they're concentration dependent. So act directly at a distance is important because there is quite a bit of debate about whether morphogens act through relay systems or, for instance, when the tissue is small, by juxtaposing cells in talking to each other. But actually, the interesting thing about morphogens is that they do move through the tissue and they act directly at a distance. So, for instance, this is the wing disc with DPP being expressed here at the boundary between the posterior and the anterior cells. This is just a Laxey reporter showing the region in which DPP is made. And then you can see there are two target genes that are turned on by DPP signaling. The first is SPALT in a restricted domain, and therefore it's called a high threshold response gene, and then OMB in a larger, wider domain considered to be a lower threshold response. Now, if you knock out the receptor for DPP away from the source, so imagine the DPP source is here, and this is thick vein receptor staining, and you lose, a reporter for thick vein receptor. You lose the receptor in a cell, then you lose also the target gene. So this shows you that cells far from the source need to receive the DPP signal, suggesting that the DPP actually moves to the cell and signals there. But this was only inferred until recently, and that's what I want to show you. Recent developments were that finally these morphogen gradients, at least the two in the disc, can be visualized. And this is in particular an antibody staining against wingless protein, which Norbert showed you quite a few pictures of. It's at the boundary between the dorsal and the ventral cells. And what you can see is that not only is it present at the source of production, but it also spreads. So you've already seen much of this. And Norbert showed a very similar picture. You can do a staining whereby instead of first permeabilizing cells to allow antibody to get in, and then detection, what you do is you first put antibody and then fix and permeabilize. So you're only detecting extracellular proteins. And if you do that, for instance, with a control with tubulin, which you know is intracellular, you don't get any signal. But if you do it with wingless, then you get a signal. So this shows you that the wingless protein, which spreads, actually is also spreading extracellularly, or is at least part of the time present extracellularly. And this is just a close-up of the wingless gradient. So this was the first visualization of a morphogen gradient in the Drosophila disc. And this was done by Maura Sigini. Again, this is just a quick experiment to show you that wingless protein is partly extracellular. You can take the tissue and add protease, which digests any proteins that are available, so extracellular proteins. And if you do this and then detect various types of proteins, so fascicline, for instance, which is present in an untreated disc, disappears when you treat it with this protease, and that's what you would expect because fascicline is a cell surface protein. An intracellular protein, such as tubulin, is not degraded upon protease treatment, and wingless is degraded roughly by half. So this shows you that the wingless protein is both intracellular and extracellular. We did something similar for DPP. We wanted to visualize the gradient. The difficulty is that, first of all, it's hard to raise antibodies to DPP because it's highly homologous to the mouse, BMP2. So if you inject it, you don't get an immune response from mouse. And secondly, the other problem is that DPP is actually processed. So it originally forms as a union between a prodomain and a ligand, which then gets cleaved, and the ligand then is secreted in signals. So we wanted to make a reporter construct with GFP. So we had to put it here in the middle so that when you get a cleavage event, then you get a GFP ligand that gets secreted into the extracellular space. This is just a blot to show you that it works. And in particular, an important thing is that this DPP-GFP fusion protein can rescue ADPP loss of function. In other words, it can replace the endogenous DPP. And this is just a picture of a fly wing when you remove much of the DPP. This is a normal fly wing. And when you replace the normal DPP with a DPP-GFP construct, you get growth of the wing once again. And not only does the adult wing look pretty normal, but if you look at target genes also are activated in the disc. So this is a functional DPP. Again, if you look at this, visualize it in the disc, you see that there's a very large, strong production towards the center, and then you have a non-autonomous spreading of DPP ligand outside the area of production. So up to this point.
Why do you have an asymmetry in the distribution? You think there is a very sharp boundary on the right and not on the left?
So the reason is that this is the AP boundary right here, so the cells can't cross over, whereas the producing cells, as they divide and grow, in a way are moving out in this direction. So this is perdurance of non-secreted DPP, whereas this is a tight separation of cells.
The meaningful area here, in terms of cells picking up and detecting signal, is this flat area.
Absolutely.
Out there.
Right.
The sources, the big high peak that you see first is just source, but the information content is really out in this flat area that's.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, so for instance, one could debate whether the construct that we have is actually secreted and processed efficiently. Because if it's not, then what you're seeing here is just unsecreted DPP. And what you should concentrate on is just, as you're saying, just this this slope here. So if we were to take this picture and cut it down and magnify just this area, that would be the gradient.
I'm confused with the AP boundaries.
So these are posterior cells, these are anterior cells, and the boundary is right there. So this bright stripe here are cells on the anterior side which are producing the DPP, but then you do see this spreading of DPP that's going out into the posterior. But the question previously was why there's such a tight cut here versus here, and that's due to cells moving. Okay, so this is just a summary of what I've told you so far about these morphogens, which is that they're localized, they're made in a localized source, that they form a concentration gradient, that a large percentage of them is found extracellularly. The same is true for DPP, I didn't show you, that they act directly at a distance and that they specify cell fate. So there are three open questions in my mind which I think are interesting to talk about. And the first has been touched upon already, is the mechanism of spreading. The second is has also been touched upon, but in terms of bicoid, which is how it is that if you get different tissue sizes, this one patterning system can properly pattern the tissues no matter what size they are. So we call that size accommodation. And then the third is a discrepancy between what we see as the ligand gradient and the activity gradient. Sure.
You have also these different stages, smaller distances, latitudes.
We did not do that. We did a different type of experiment, which I'll talk about, modifying the size of the tissue.
Did anyone see how the cell changing with the size?
So, yes. As the tissue grows, a smaller percentage. So, if there are cells which were originally expressing Spalt because they were near the DPP source, as the tissue grows, they stop expressing Spalt. So they move out of the source of, away from the source. So they move down the gradient.
Spalt, during the growth, the size of the Spalt gene,
that's
proportional to the size of the
disc. Yes. So the Spalt domain, yes. The gradient itself, we don't know, and that we have to look at more carefully. Spalt domain, yes.
They express Spalt in a new way from the source to turn off Spalt?
They turn off Spalt, that's true. So then, that would suggest then actually quite the opposite. The Spalt later on is a smaller percentage of the disk.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have the size accommodation over the
development
not just
on
the mutation.
Sorry, say that again?
So you can say that you have the size accommodation during the growth of the.
So it depends. So if indeed we believe, from that experiment that the cells are moving out of the spalt domain. Therefore, the spalt domain is becoming narrower. Then I'm not sure if you want to call that size accommodation. I'm backing up.
The complication, just to get it straight in my mind, is that if a disk is growing,
right,
then you either have to get your DPP out farther to maintain spalt,
right,
if you want to maintain proportions, or the spalt, the size of the spalt domain will change, or something else is giving you, contributing to the size regulation.
Right, exactly. And
so in other words, spalt is on while the disk is small.
Right.
Thank you. I haven't appreciated.
So spalt is on throughout the growth of the disk.
Thank you very much. I have not understood that.
And I guess I am backing out, and what I'm saying is that the percentage of the disk that is spalt positive decreases with time.
Which, is, in the simplest view, would mean that DPP is diffusing at the same rate, has the same concentration 10 cells away, and that concentration is sufficient to activate spalt. Everything below that concentration, when the cell gets outside that range, it turns off spalt.
It's very, very possible.
And then you have trouble.
Then you have
then size regulation. It's not fair to expect a young disk and an old disk to have the same size regulation properly.
But you do run into trouble though, because then it's hard to explain why, if at the end of the day you have different tissue sizes, you still have scaled patterning.
We'll return to exactly that tomorrow.
Yeah, but that's
it. But do the spreading. You haven't done spreading yet.
Right. Okay. So, as far as I know, 5 mechanisms of spreading have been suggested. Some of them passive, some of them active. I'll go through many of them, but I just wanted to give you a quick description of each one. Cell growth is a mechanism by which you anticipate that the cells, by growing, will actually move the DPP. So if the DPP binds to the cells and is fairly stable, then the cells growing will spread it. Diffusion is fairly clear. Bucket brigade is one in which the cells actually pass the DPP from cell to cell. The reason I've made it half passive, half active is because I could imagine this either being a passive process whereby you have passive diffusion of, let's say, a receptor for DPP along the surface of the cell, which then releases and absorbs the DPP, or you could imagine actually an active process of moving the receptor along the surface of the cell. So that's a little unclear, and perhaps Lewis might want to describe this better. But the fourth is transcytosis, in which cells take up DPP on one side and then re-secrete it on a different side. And then the fifth are cytokine transport, which I'll talk about right now. The reason I'm talking about this first is because it's the one that involves least modeling and kind of in physics. So I'll get rid of that one first, and then we'll talk about ones that involve more modeling. Yeah. So the cytokine proposal is based on a discovery that all cells in the disk actually have long projections from their cell body towards the DPP source. In fact, I've heard that it's thought that they also have projections going the other way. But in any case, for us, what's relevant are these projections towards the DPP source. If you look at them on the side of the disk, so in cross-section, then these cytonemes occur on the apical side of the cells. And what's interesting is that if you look at DPP localization, you look at it as a section, you notice that most of the DPP is actually in the basolateral surface. So most of the DPP is in this region, just like wingless. So it's a little difficult to explain these apical processes spreading the DPP if it's mainly basolateral. So
I guess one could argue that, you know, that the wing, the DPP that we detect in grass is the one that's actually relevant to the morphogenic activity.
It could be that. I mean, but there, I think you have to come up with a difficult explanation. You would have to say that the DPP, which is relevant, is actually either a very small percentage of it or something that you lost and can't detect that is up here. It's possible. It's possible. That's also possible that it moves very quickly through the cytonemes and then enters the cell body of the cell that secreted the cytoneme. But if that were the case, I would expect to see some DPP or concentration of DPP apically. But
so what's the level of detection? How many molecules you think can detect in
I have no idea. I don't know.
Yes, yeah, that's sort of the problem. A lot of problems here.
But
yeah,
combining this with some data that I'll show you soon, the DPP is very unstable. It degrades within 3 hours. So to have this much DPP out here, you would have to have quite a large flux of DPP going up along the apical surface, and you don't see any of it. So I'm not saying it's not possible. I think it's possible, but. In fact, I think this is a live disk, so it's not fixed. It's just a disk that you squish under a slide and you look at it right away.
So I was confused about the settings. So the consensus is that they do exist?
Or yes.
It's just to have proxy
response? No, I think it's clear that they exist.
Okay. That they exist, but the issue of hypoxia has that been addressed? I mean, the one issue is that they exist. And the other thing is, why do they exist? And has it been excluded that they aren't a product of hypoxia?
So hypoxia is not having a O2.
Right. I don't know. I haven't heard that point. Another trouble, actually, with these cytonemes is if you want to claim that the cytonemes are transporting the DPP, then you have to say that the cells are somehow sending these projections towards the source. And then you have to claim that there's some other signal that's calling the cytonemes towards the source to then transport back to DPP. So then what's that other signal and how's that one moving?
But also there's a problem. I don't see how the cytonemes you set up a gradient.
If you had, for instance, degradation in within the cytoneme. But I agree. Yep.
Concentration can be very large.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think to see this much DPP out here, you would have to see it getting there. So, okay, so accepting that it's.
It could be that the DPP just sends at the tip of the cytoneme and then the second messenger system in the cytoneme itself. And then depending on the distance, you can measure, depending on the decay and the distance, you can measure where you are.
Yes.
Then there is no more of the gradient.
But then all of this is irrelevant.
And the receptor result argues fairly strongly against not meeting the.
Well, but I mean, the cell that's here that's missing TKV would also presumably be missing TKV at the tip of its cytoneme.
No, but you would explain the location of protein there.
So you would be saying basically that. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't make this a very big, strong red X.
But we're all happy to see it there. Right?
Okay. This reflects my belief. Then, if it's the truth, let's see.
But you also said that you need an active. If you have a sig bang, which is there, but protein inactive, can you get on the cytosis? You need activity of the receptor.
So I'll show you in a second. There's some clones that are missing TKV activity that in a paper by Enchev. And I don't know if the protein is still there. That's exactly. In the paper, they say missing activity. And in that, so I don't know if it's a protein, no. Yeah. And in that case, they claim they don't see internalization of DPP. Now, I assume if it were protein null, which is what they really wanted, they would have said protein null, but they said missing activity, but I don't know. So, okay, this I think I can refute a little bit more strongly, cell growth. So cell growth is the mechanism by which the growth of the tissue actually spreads the DPP. So for instance, if you have a cell here that has DPP on its surface, when it divides, then the concentration drops by half. It divides again, the concentration drops by half, and what you have at the end is a gradient of DPP. Now, in order to be able to accomplish a gradient in this manner, what you need is a molecule that's stable within the time frame of the growth of the tissue. So that's a hypothesis that you can study, and we did, by doing a pulse chase type of experiment. And the way it works is, in this case, we're not using radioactivity, but we're using biotinylation. So you biotinylate proteins, and then you specifically pull down biotinylated proteins, and you detect them. And if you do this with fasciclin 2, which is a stable cell surface protein, you biotinylate it, you pull it down, you detect it, it's there. If you wait 3 hours and then you pull it down and you detect it, it's still there. So almost all of the protein which you originally labeled is still present. If you do this with wingless, which has been shown to be significantly less stable, you see that there's a large reduction in the amount of protein that's still there and biotinylated 3 hours later. Yeah. If you do this with DPP, you almost entirely lose signal. So this suggests that within 3 hours, DPP is largely turned over.
Because formally you've got a problem with its tag GFP.
It's tagged with GFP.
Which conceivably could affect stability.
Yes, I mean, so it could conceivably affect the stability, but it works similar to endogenous. So we could say nature could have chosen to use DPP, GFP, and everything would work fine. The question is, though, maybe if the biotinylation is occurring on the GFP and then it's cleaving and then you still have DPP, there could be something. Right.
Isn't there something that against that model? Because that model requires that the pattern of cell division be perpendicular to the AP boundary, and the fact that the pattern of cell division remains parallel.
Hold on, sorry, I lost. there was one question here, which was whether the DPP might not actually be mainly intracellular, which is why you can't detect it. And right. And previous to this, I did an experiment showing that it's mostly extracellular. So the DPP-GFP ligand, so the part that's processed, cleaved, and secreted, is almost entirely extracellular because it's degraded almost entirely by extracellular protease treatment. So, and sorry, I didn't catch that. Yes. So the growth is not perpendicular to the DPP gradient. But nonetheless, even if the growth were in all directions, that would spread out the DPP gradient because from base, meaning in the opposite direction. Do they mainly grow in that direction?
They grow in every direction.
I think they do grow in every direction.
I thought that the fact that you can get the whole of the one compartment from just a few cells that grow faster than the others shows that it cannot possibly be due to it. Because they spread everywhere.
But they could be, if the DPP were stable enough, they could be bringing the DPP with them.
But they would take it in very funny directions.
So that's in the minute
case. No, that's what's wrong. It's a perfectly normal
way. But,
you see what I mean?
But I think this shows that it's just not possible because the DPP is only stable within 3 hours and it takes several days for the tissue to grow. Okay. So here's another experiment then. You have a disc. You remove the signaling which induces DPP production for 24 hours, and then you look at downstream effects of DPP, and you don't. So you look in particular at PMAD staining, phosphorylated MAD, and MAD becomes phosphorylated upon reception of the DPP signal. I have, I think, a diagram of that here. So DPP is received by the receptor, thick veins, the receptor phosphorylates MAD, and you can design an antibody that specifically recognizes the phosphorylated MAD. And so if you do that, you, after 24 hours, you don't have any phosphorylated MAD. Then if you do a recovery experiment, so you allow, in this particular case, hedgehog to be produced again, hedgehog is secreted, it binds receiving cells, the receiving cells receive the hedgehog signal, they turn on DPP, and then finally DPP spreads and activates the phosphorylated MAD. Within 2 hours, you start seeing it. Within 4 hours, it spreads. Within 7 hours, you have almost a normal-looking phosphorylated MAD gradient. So in this case, you have a tissue that is almost entirely formed, and within 7 hours, you have the gradient reforming. So I think this shows that you can have DPP gradient formation without substantial tissue growth. And the flies, I have no idea, actually. I think so, but I didn't test. No. So I think this one more, is out.
Does that experiment allow you to get sort of kinetics of the sort of kinetics and all sorts of kind of numerical details on gradient formation that would help a lot with modeling?
Yes, absolutely. So that's exactly what I was going to say later, which is these types of experiments then, if you do modeling, allow you to put in parameters such as the half-life of the DPP, the speed in which the gradient is forming, and then these are the types of parameters you need in order to rule out mechanisms or, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now I'll talk a little bit about transcytosis. Transcytosis was proposed because the thinking at the time was that the diffusivity of DPP protein in the extracellular gradient is so low that it can't possibly be going anywhere. So to go somewhere, you need it basically to be moved by cells. Endocytosed, resecreted. And it doesn't have to be necessarily in a directional manner. Even if it's completely random, it'll effectively increase the diffusivity of DPP. And there were some really nice experiments done by Enchev in Gonzalez-Gaitan's lab, in which they make clones that are Shibiri mutant. That means that they can no longer endocytose and exocytose. And if you do that, you see that behind the clone, away from the source of DPP, you see shadows. There. It seems to be fairly systematic. So this would seem to be a fairly strong evidence in support of this idea of endocytosis and resecretion being important for movement of the DPP. It says Shibiri is important. Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. And in particular, to me, there were a few things that looked a little funny about these clones. For instance, if you look at this clone here, you have basically a block here, but then you have a clone that seems to extend out. Same here, it extends out. But on the other hand here, where it's fairly protected, you see DPP. So to me, that was a little bit funny. Same thing here, you see a gradient and then the clone extends out. This is more the type of clone that I would expect. On the other hand, there's always variability in experiments, so this doesn't mean very much. But why do you see dots inside the clones? That's also a good question. I don't know. It could be perdurance, perhaps. These are clones that are, so you first make the clone of a temperature-sensitive allele, then you shift for 3 to 5 hours at a certain point. So it could be that within I don't know. Because
ask a general question with all these dots. How much does, I mean, you too know that. I mean, how much cell biology is known about what these dots really represent? I mean, you all rather glibly say these are kind of endocytosis and stuff.
Well,
has anyone done electron microscopy on it? No. Really known what these things are?
No. The most as far.
Everyone rather depends on them, their interpretations.
So what I know is that. So I have tried a little bit of cell biology to look at what these dots are. I know that these dots, first of all, colocalize with thick vein dots, with receptor dots, and that receptor dots colocalize with internalized transferrin receptor, human transferrin receptor. But besides that, whether they're recycling endosomes, lysosomes, I don't think anything is known.
Okay. Because, I mean, a long time ago, people used to call multi-vesicular bodies. I suspect that was just a big word for dogs. Didn't really know what they were then either.
Right.
But actually, trying to work out what they are might help with these interpretations.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, the idea is that the autosomes go into the MDBs, and then it goes into the lysosomes.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's cool. Do you actually know that's true in your case?
No, in this case, but at least from the central region.
Another piece of data which seemed a little funny was that if you make a region of cells that is missing thick veins, so the receptor, and you look inside, what you see actually is an accumulation of DPP. And that too, so they claim that it's just DPP entering by diffusion, and it's not getting degraded, so it's just accumulating. But this seems a little bit funny, and the reason I'm saying is that recently, there was a paper by Arthur Lander at UC Irvine, and they did quite a bit of modeling of this system. And so I just wanted to show you how some modeling can shed some light onto these various questions that, just by intuition, are a little bit difficult to go through. In particular, they did the following modeling system. They said, if you have ligand that's being produced at a certain speed, and that is also diffusing at a certain rate, and you say that it can bind a receptor and then be internalized and degraded, and that the receptor itself can also be internalized and degraded and is being produced at a certain speed, and you have some of these parameters and others you infer to be within a certain range of reasonability, then what you can show by using the types of experiments that I showed you before to then get rates of degradation and rates of gradient formation is that you can actually form extracellular gradients simply by diffusion. So in other words, what people thought that there's no way that the protein could diffuse through the extracellular space in a fast enough at a fast enough clip that it would actually form a gradient, that's actually not true, that it is plausible to form an extracellular gradient by simple diffusion. Okay. And in fact, if you look at the kinetics, then you see that diffusion, which you can determine a diffusivity constant for a protein of that given size, would allow you to form a gradient. But if you look at, for instance, transcytosis, and you say, well, the endocytosis rate is about, you need roughly 2 minutes to endocytose a protein, then you get diffusivities that are too slow to actually account for the speed of gradient formation. If you wanted to form a DPP gradient within the speed that we just saw, you would need an endocytosis rate, an endocytosis that takes a fraction of a minute, so maybe like 10 seconds or so per endocytosis, just endocytosis alone. You need to then account for its movement through the cells and re-exocytosis. So by actually doing some type of modeling, you can probably say that transcytosis is unfavored because of kinetics. The Bunkert Brigade, which says, well, you can have diffusivity along the membrane, is still within a reasonable realm that could explain movement. Yep.
I wrote to Lander about this. It's based on a misunderstanding of the Bunkert Brigade. Because if you have to rely on certain membrane diffusion, it would be no better than diffusion. I mean, it would just be replacing volume diffusion by membrane diffusion. The Bunkert Brigade is among receptors, it's not among cells.
Yep.
Right? So there's an active motion of the receptor from one receptor molecule to the next. It's not diffusion.
If I understand correctly, I think we agree. In other words, Lander said, In his paper, he said that he thought Bunkert Brigade was too slow. What I'm saying is that I think it's actually within acceptably fast speeds. Yeah.
But it's not diffusion proper. I mean, it's not membrane diffusion. You don't wait for the thing to move along with the receptor.
So how does it work? How does Bunkert Brigade work?
Well, the paper, it's an active...
That should come up in the discussion. Yeah. We shouldn't get too stuck on it at the moment. But I think it's an important point in the discussion. You could go to the board and share it here.
What's there?
This model assumes the cells sit utterly still, right?
Right.
is that a fact that the cells sit utterly still?
In so what part of the modeling are you looking at? In other words, if you consider that the gradient forms within a certain number of hours, then in terms of movement in space, then I think you can more or less model it. The cells are sitting still. But I don't know if you're thinking of some other effect like.
Well, for early embryos, the cell, everything's sloshing around dramatically, really dramatically, every 8 or so minutes. There's large scale, highly dynamic motions of everything laterally.
Right.
And I would assume that would smear out gradients dramatically. And I just don't know if in other tissues, like in natural disc, whether the cells slosh around the way they do in early embryos.
I would say not as much. At least, if they slosh around, they all slosh around together. That if you make a clone of cells, the clone of cell tends to stay in one area. You won't find the cells dispersed throughout.
As in an early embryo, but the cells moving one way cause the fluid to flow the other way. The fluid stirs everything up. Even though the cells maintain their nearest neighbors
together. Yeah. I don't know what other people think, but I would say that the tissue in this case is fairly forms the structure. Let's say that they're not moving within another structure.
And the sloshing around in an early embryo is due to largely associated with mitoses, and the cell cycle time that you're dealing with in the disc is not 9 minutes, but
8 hours.
12 hours.
Yeah.
I find something wrong. The sloshing would make the diffusion go yet faster. It's fast enough. Yes.
Okay. Furthermore, if you look at it in terms of modeling at what happens here in this clone that's missing receptor, then if you say that the ligand, the free ligand, is getting in by diffusion, then you have to accept that the free ligand can also get out by diffusion. And in fact, the free ligand should equilibrate between these two sides, and it shouldn't be any higher. There's no ligand source here. So the free ligand should be the same. And if the free ligand is the same, then, for instance, if you say it binds to proteoglycans, then the amount of binding should be the same. So in terms of looking at it this way, it's difficult to explain why you would actually see higher levels of DPP inside a clone such as this, unless there's something going on that hasn't been taken into account that you don't know about. And for instance, as Norbert Perrimon was saying this morning, if you, for instance, upregulate levels of proteoglycans, you can bind these morphogens. So this is an example of overexpression of DALI-like, which binds higher levels of wingless. So if something is going on in that clone that upregulates some of the nonspecific binding, or I shouldn't say nonspecific, but some of the proteoglycans, then that could explain what's going on, but not simply the fact that you've blocked endocytosis. OK, so this is. No, that's from your paper. It's a different construct, but very similar. They fused the GFP to within a couple of amino acids of where we fused it. So apparently it gets processed and secreted a little bit more efficiently. But
did you repeat those experiments with the Shabir and the
mutant? I did not, because I also have another personal reason for not liking those experiments very much, which is that I did those experiments at the time. But what I did is I first checked to see if I block endocytosis, within what time frame do the cells start dying. And within 3 hours, they're fine. But once after 3 hours, the cells start dying, as you can see by various apoptotic markers. Their experiments were done blocking endocytosis for 5 hours. So I didn't feel like repeating that. Yes. So no, typically the Galfour system vastly overexpresses a protein, maybe 10 times more than normal. The question then is, in this case here, is it possible that it's not being secreted and processed efficiently enough so that you get an accumulation in the cells, but you still get the same amount of DPP outside as possible? But I would tend to say that the US Galfour system usually overexpresses something like tenfold or something. threefold or something.
We have an antibody against
the Western. No, we wish we did, but we have one that kind of works in Western.
So
kind
of. The endogenous DPP versus the US DPP.
Yeah.
DPP, is it the same, or?
We haven't done that, but I would assume that it's much higher. But we haven't done that.
I'm a little confused because I thought that overexpressing DPP will cause all kinds of messing up with happening. And the GFP, the GFP construct presumably is as functional as the regular thing. So can it really be
so regulated? Right. So if you overexpress DPP, for instance, there is a UAS DPP, and overexpression of UAS DPP and UAS DPP GFP have very similar effects. That they cause overgrowth in the lateral sides of the disc, and then the larva dies during metamorphosis, and then you see virtually the same phenotype with DPP and with DPP-GFP. So in terms of strength, they should be more or less the same. It rescues the loss of function. So if you remove DPP and then you put back DPP-GFP, then it rescues. But if you overexpress it in a wild-type background, then it's lethal.
So it's the extent of the overexpression. You can say that if you overexpress it moderately, then it's okay if you really go wild.
Yeah, or if you overexpress it in the background where you've removed endogenous, then you're fine.
Is that true for also the MT
version? Yeah. Okay, the second issue, yes?
So if you, you kind of dismiss transcytosis, but so what are those dots? What are they used for? You have to give an interpretation because most of the DPP seems to be as a degradation or?
I believe, well, one possible explanation is that you need endocytosis of DPP in order to achieve signaling. That could be one explanation. That those are being degraded, but you need endocytosis for signaling. For instance, I think EGF, or there are multiple signaling molecules that need endocytosis to signal. So that could be one explanation, that they're just being endocytosed and then degraded. And they're probably lysosomal.
So they're opposite, I mean, I don't think they're good candidates to be transcytotic vesicles just because purely in scale, they're definitely beyond the vesicle size.
And there are also some indicate. For instance, there's another component of the PI3 of the DPP pathway called SARA, which brings MAD to the thick vein receptor. And if you don't have SARA, then you don't get signaling. And SARA also has a domain that binds, I think it's PI P245, which is enriched in endosomes. So it's possible that SARA actually recruits all of the components to endosomes, which is why you need endosomes.
I get an argument to move on to SARA.
Okay.
So, it's not that this isn't important, but we could be here for a very long time.
This is very similar to a slide that we saw this morning. Rather than being eggs of different types of flies, these are wings. This is the Drosophila melanogaster that we work with in the lab. And I went around the UMBL and I found a Drosophila that is endogenous to the Heidelberg area, which is bigger. And then I found the housefly, which is also bigger. And what you can see is that amongst these different genuses and species, you have a patterning system that's very similar with veins and so forth, but the tissue is different, and yet it is patterned correctly. It's different in size, but patterned correctly. And I was going to say that probably the patterning system is exactly the same, but can properly pattern different sized tissues. We didn't look at it molecularly, but your lab, I think, did a much better job at that. In any case, what you can do is you can modify one part of a fly wing in the lab genetically. You can make it overgrow in the posterior domain. And what you see is that the...
How did you do that?
By overexpress, well, the lab did a screen for genes that do exactly this.
Oh, I see. It's not DPP.
It's not DPP. Yeah. And in such a case, you get a scaling of the patterning. So the point is that if this also, for instance, Drosophila, depending on how much food you give it while it's growing, it'll grow to different sizes. And yet, if it's small or big, it still has all its various components. So somehow this patterning system can compensate for different tissue sizes. And the question is, how is that happening? This is another example of a fly wing where the posterior was made very small, And typically this vein here, vein 5, would be out here, but it has scaled in. So how does this happen at the level of DPP? Because DPP is actually responsible for patterning in this orientation. And this is, again, just what it looks like in the disk. And so we wanted to look at it, rather than looking at it at the final adult stage, look at it slightly earlier during larval growth. And we did the following experiment. This is a wild-type disk marked for the posterior compartment in green. And in red is one of the target genes of DPP called SPALT. Now, if you overgrow, if you cause the posterior compartment to overgrow by expressing an activated form of PI3 kinase, then what you can do is you can measure the new SPALT domain, and you can compare it to the anterior, which has stayed normal-sized, and you can see that it has expanded in size. If in the posterior compartment you drive expression of a dominant negative PI3 kinase, you get a smaller posterior compartment, and you get a smaller SPALT domain. So, so it is affecting cell size and cell number, both.
Cell number as well.
I think it's slightly modifying cell number, and it's also modifying cell size.
Looking at DPP distributions here.
I wish we were, but it's not. It's just the target gene SPALT. Yeah.
So going back to the argument about the scaling,
yeah.
I think that here
here it scales.
You modify the shape of the gradient, the response to the gradient.
Yeah.
In a way, that's directly analogous to the hunchback result, where
yes.
What you modify is the readout. You could imagine the DP gradient. DPP gradient is the same, but if the SPALT boundary, like the hunchback boundary, reflected an additional input from the edge
yep.
of the disk,
yep.
then by changing the dimensions of the compartment, you would shift the size regulation
yes.
would occur at the level of response rather than at the level of the shape of the gradient.
So the big question is whether the gradient scales or not. That's the big question. We weren't able to do it just for technical reasons at the time, but you're right. So it could. We were also saying exactly the same thing. There's factor X coming from the side, forming an inverse gradient, and potentially.
How about Brinker?
It can't be Brinker, and I'll show you why right now. So first of all, you can quantitate this. You can plot the size of the SPALT domain as a normalized to the size of the disk, because there's always some variability in the size of the disk. So you measure the SPALT domain as a percentage of that. And these are the wild-type disks. They cluster here. In the large disks where PI3 kinase is expressed, so they have a larger size, and the SPALT domain is larger. In smaller disks, the SPALT domain is smaller. And it forms a nice linear relationship.
Those numbers at the bottom are like microns or something?
So these are
absolutely.
Posterior size as a percentage of total disk size. So 50%.
Percentage of disk size.
Yeah, so 50% would mean that the disk is half posterior, half anterior. So normal disks are roughly 40% posterior, 60% anterior. That's so it's completely normalized for absolute size. So why can't it be Brinker? So what I showed you was the size accommodation at this level, at the target gene level. So we thought, why don't we try to go further upstream and look at phosphorylated MAD? Does phosphorylated MAD, yes? Back up. Within a single population, that's right. There doesn't seem to be any correlation, or you can just say they're tightly clustered. Right. Okay, so if we look at phospho-MAD, then a staining in the disk gives you, again, a domain in which this phosphorylated MAD is phosphorylated. And if you do the same experiment, again, you see exactly that. So the point is that Brinker acts down here. Brinker does not act up here. And in fact, in anticipation, of that question. Oops, sorry. Okay, fine. But here, this is a clone overexpressing Brinker. SPALT levels are down, but it doesn't affect the phosphorylated MAD. Okay, that's coming right up. Okay. Actually, it's, I'll get to it in a second. So the point is now that this size accommodation, as we were saying, can happen either at the ligand level or at a different level involving the receptor, the MAD phosphorylation, and so forth. So it's a slightly more complicated issue. So let's consider first the ligand level. As I was saying, there's two possibilities. If the ligand were stable, then you could imagine that tissue growth would spread out the ligand, and as a result, there would be an inherent coupling between the gradient and the tissue size. But that's not the case, and instead, the ligand is unstable. And as I showed you, you can reform de novo the gradient in a tissue that's already of large size. So it's difficult to explain how you could get this coupling between the ligand levels and the gradients, the ligand gradient and the tissue size. One way. That could be. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. If you have, yes. So if you diluted out the protease, then you would get it to spread further. That could be one way. Yeah. Or the other way would be if somehow you had so-called fixed boundary conditions, so that the level at the end of the disc were pegged to zero, and the level at the production site were pegged to a certain value, and then that would automatically scale. But this raises several issues. One is, well, how do you peg BPP levels exactly to zero or to whatever level at the end? Secondly, what you have, isn't it really a flux boundary condition? In other words, is there a constant production of BPP, or is the level somehow fixed by some feedback mechanism? That's possible. And the third problem to this would be that you need diffusion to be large enough and degradation to be small enough so that you don't just have a decay like this that doesn't care how much tissue there is, but you need fairly fast diffusion and low degradation. So there are several issues to this model, and the protease model is, a perfectly good one. So. Which is why when you first asked me the question, I just assumed, well, what I see here is, so I answered straight away, you do see scaling, but that's an open question. Okay, so the other possibility is that you have scaling at the level of phospho-MAD, and that it involves some complicated combination of factors with the receptor, internalization, phosphorylation, and so forth, and that this does not directly correlate to DPP levels. And that's the third question which I wanted to discuss, because in fact, that is the case, that if you look at the DPP gradient, out here you have some linear, well, in this picture you can't see it very well, but it's a linear gradient out here. If you look at levels of phosphorylated MAD, they seem to have somewhat of a plateau with a small effect, which I'll tell you about in a second, and that they drop off rapidly. So there does not seem to be a simple direct correlation between deep ligand levels and phosphorylated MAD levels.
And have you shown us how the phosphorylated MAD varies in various size?
Exactly. Yes, so the phospho-MAD does accommodate for size. So some things you can explain. For instance, what is this dip here in phosphorylated MAD levels? And you can explain that by looking at receptor levels, thick veins. If you look at TKV, you see that there's a depression in thick vein levels in the middle of the disc, and this is caused by hedgehog signaling. So if you make a profile of that, you'll see that in red are thick vein levels. Thick vein levels are fairly constant, and then they drop, and they drop exactly where phosphorylated MAD levels drop. Then they both go up a little bit, and then again you have a discontinuity which is somewhat difficult to explain, and another discontinuity which is difficult to explain, both here and here. So this is something where a modeling of the system would definitely be helpful. There are other.
I have a question about the data. So
wiggly.
Yeah. Right.
Is that mean or is that self-grown?
Well, so the, I would say that's, you know, you can think of it as noise, or you can think of it as real. I don't know. It's basically, if you take an average along the entire width of this and you do it all the way through, you do get this squiggliness.
This is a single disk and a single measurement across the disk.
Yeah, so this is one single disk, this one here, that has actually is mutant for endogenous DPP and has DPP GFP. And then it is measurement of the phosphorylated MAD levels and thick vein levels in this one disk.
So if you do a bunch of lines across and sum them, you might get rid of the squiggles in part come because you hit the cell surface, you hit nuclei.
Yes, it's definitely nuclei and so forth, but this is already an integration along the entire width. So the only way to get rid of this noise would be to either use multiple disks. Or
that's weird, but you would even summing over the along yeah. that whole.
I mean, for instance, there's this patch here of tissue, and I think it's just and there's a yeah, it's strange, but that's how it is. I think in this case here.
Were you sure that's at the beginning of the
GFP? Yeah. I would say rather, so the integration is vertical, but here maybe this stripe is slightly at an angle, and then the tissue, so not only is the stripe slightly at an angle this way, but in cross-section, the cells can also be skewed a little bit that way, so you start getting to some cells that are producing, yeah. So, when thinking about this, the receptor actually plays a slightly more complicated role in that it does two things. The first is that it actually sensitizes cells to DPP signal. So what you're seeing in red here and also shown here is SPALT, so the high threshold response gene to DPP. These are clones overexpressing wild type thick veins. So cells that you can see here that normally would not be activating SPALT do. So the cells are sensitized to DPP. On the other hand, DPP also reduces the diffusivity of the molecule. If you look behind this clone here, you see a slightly dark area, whereas here you see that it grades out, here you see it grades out. So somehow it reduces the diffusivity, so cells behind will not receive as much DPP, but it also sensitizes cells to DPP. So that's another complicated effect, I think, of what thick vein does that is worth looking at and modeling. Another component to the system is an inhibitory SMAD. And what this does is it looks like a phosphorylated MAD, and it competes for this this co-SMAD so that if you have inhibitory SMAD, you no longer get signaling into the nucleus. And if you look at levels of this inhibitory SMAD, I don't have a specific profile, but they are higher in the middle and lower at the edges. So there, too, it's possible that combining this inhibitory effect that's high in the middle and low on the edges with an activation profile can give you a sharper drop-off. We don't know. And furthermore, there are many other effects that could be affecting the translation of DPP levels into activity levels. And for instance, so I've mentioned thick vein levels, I've mentioned inhibitory SMADs. There could be receptor cooperativity. There could be internalization that's important and degradation rates. So there are many different components which will be needed to translate DPP levels to phosphomad levels. And so I just wanted to finish with a few conclusions and many open questions. In terms of the DPP gradient formation, I've shown you that it's actually a high flux system. So it's being made quickly, moves quickly, and is degraded quickly. As a result, well, tissue growth is too slow, and cytonemes unlikely but possible, I suppose. And that, as a whole, the mechanism is still unclear. In terms of size accommodation, it's interesting that it occurs at a high level. It does not occur at the gene target level, but rather either at the ligand level or immediately at receptor phosphorylation and so forth. And that it may involve this somewhat complex translation of DPP into phospho-MAD levels. And again, the mechanism is still unclear. And last thing, I would like to acknowledge Malis Pugini, who did all the work on wingless gradient formation, and Steve Cohen, whose lab I'm in, and I'm both honored and very happy to be working with.
And he's very naughty not to have come. As I'm told. Yes.